Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio from Monday, May 10th, 2021. President Joe Biden saying there's no evidence so far that Russia is involved in the Colonial Pipeline ransomware attack, but the criminals behind it are likely in Russia, and so the president says that country has a responsibility to act. White House also saying it's not yet seen oil and gas supply shortages, but it's monitoring the situation. This is likely the largest successful cyber attack on a U.S. utility in history. Pipeline operators say that things could be back up and running by the end of the week. President Biden this week holding his first meeting with the top congressional leaders from both parties, as well as other meetings with lawmakers, focusing on his jobs and infrastructure plan, with the continuing question of whether a bipartisan deal can be reached. The House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy officially schedules a vote for Wednesday by House Republican members on whether Conference Chair Liz Cheney should be removed from her number three leadership post. Vote will be by secret ballot and behind closed doors. Cheney continues to criticize former President Donald Trump over his false claims of election fraud. And today, another Republican House member, Adam Kinzinger, defending Cheney and says it's the House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, who should be ousted. Violence in Jerusalem as Palestinians protest an annual march by Israeli nationalists, and then Israel and the militant group Hamas exchanging rocket fire. We'll hear from the U.S. State Department and speak with a Washington Post foreign affairs columnist. And Pete DuPont, former Republican congressman and governor from Delaware, ran for president in 1988, has died. He was 86 years old. This from the Associated Press. The operator of a major U.S. pipeline hit by a cyber attack said Monday it hopes to have service mostly restored by the end of the week. Colonial Pipeline offered the update after revealing it had halted operations because of a ransomware attack the FBI has linked to a criminal gang. The ransomware attack on the pipeline, which the company says delivers about 45% of fuel consumed on the U.S. East Coast, raised concerns that supplies of gasoline, jet fuel, and diesel could be disrupted in parts of the region if the disruption continues. President Joe Biden spoke at the White House.
I'd like to start by saying a few words about the ransomware cyber attack currently impacting Colonial Pipeline. This is something that our administration, has been tracking extremely carefully, and I have been personally briefed every day. The Department of Energy is working directly with Colonial to get the pipelines back online and operating at full capacity as quickly and safely as possible. The FBI also is engaged to assess and address this attack. The agencies across the government have acted quickly to mitigate any impact on our fuel supply. And over the weekend, at my direction, the Department of Transportation issued an emergency order to loosen restrictions on truck drivers in order to allow more fuel to be transported by a tanker. We're prepared to take additional steps depending on how quickly the company is able to bring its pipeline back to full operational capacity. The Federal Bureau of Investigation has determined Colonial's network was infected by ransomware, and it's a criminal act, obviously. FBI released details of the attack so others can take steps to prevent being infected. My administration takes issue takes this very seriously. We have efforts underway with the FBI and DOJ, Department of Justice, to disrupt and prosecute ransomware criminals. And my administration will be pursuing a global effort of ransomware attacks by transnational criminals who often use global money laundering networks to carry them out. My administration is also committed to safeguarding our critical infrastructure, much of which is privately owned and managed like Colonial. Private entities are making their own determination on cybersecurity, so to jumpstart greater private sector investment in cybersecurity, we launched a new public-private initiative in April. It begins with a 100-day sprint to improve cybersecurity in the electric sector. And we'll follow that with similar initiatives in natural gas pipelines, water, and other sectors. In addition to companies stepping up, we need to invest to safeguard our critical infrastructure. That's one of the many things my American Jobs Plan is designed to do.
President Joe Biden at the White House. The cyber group that is suspected from being behind this attack, the group of criminals, as the president described them, is called DarkSide. And they posted a statement that reads, "We are apolitical. We do not participate in geopolitics. Do not need to tie us with a defined government and look for other our motives. Our goal is to make money and not creating problems for society. From today, we introduce moderation and check each company that our partners want to encrypt to avoid social consequences in the future." President Biden was asked whether there's any connection to the Russian government.
Do you think Russia is involved at all implicitly with that attack?
I'm going to be meeting with President Putin, and so far there is no evidence based on from our intelligence people that Russia is involved, although there is evidence that the actor's ransomware is in Russia. They have some responsibility to deal with this.
Colonial Pipeline Systems spans more than 5,500 miles and transports about 45% of all fuel consumed on the U.S. East Coast. That's 2.5 million barrels per day. More on the attack and the response from the White House. Here is Deputy National Security Advisor Elizabeth Sherwood Randall in the White House briefing room.
To give you a sense of what we've been doing together since that first meeting, we have met throughout the weekend. The Department of Energy's Energy Information Agency, or EIA, is in contact with state and local agencies to assess current supply and impacts due to the shutdown. DOE has also convened the oil and natural gas and electric sector utility partners to share details about the ransomware attack and discuss recommended measures to mitigate further incidents across the industry. DHS's CISA is preparing a release to go to the broader critical infrastructure community to ensure it has visibility into the ransomware attack, and it's taking appropriate measures to protect its networks. Colonial is responsible for safely returning the pipeline to service, and our role in the federal government is to take proactive steps to analyze the impacts of the shutdown on the delivery of gasoline, diesel, and aviation fuel in states that are dependent on the pipeline, and to identify federal options for alleviating supply shortfalls should they develop. For example, to help address potential supply disruptions, the Department of Transportation issued an hours of service waiver yesterday, which provides greater flexibility to drivers transporting gasoline, diesel, jet fuel, and other refined petroleum products across 17 states, as well as the District of Columbia. Right now, there is not a supply shortage. We are preparing for multiple possible contingencies because that's our job, especially on the Homeland Security team, and considering what additional steps may be useful to mitigate any potential disruptions to supply. This weekend's events put the spotlight on the fact that our nation's critical infrastructure is largely owned and operated by private sector companies. When those companies are attacked, they serve as the first line of defense, and we depend on the effectiveness of their defenses. To improve the cybersecurity of our critical infrastructure, the Biden administration has already launched a high-priority initiative to collaborate with our private sector partners to harden our defenses and to build our nation's resilience.
Deputy National Security Advisor Elizabeth Sherwood Randall in the White House briefing room. With more on the Colonial Pipeline ransomware attack, joining us now is Maggie Miller, staff writer with The Hill. Thanks for being with us. You write that this attack is underscoring just how vulnerable critical U.S. infrastructure is to cyber criminals in a way that no previous attack has done, according to U.S. officials and experts in the field. What are they saying, and why is this different?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. And secondly, yes, this attack is unprecedented in many ways in that, you know, critical utilities such as the oil and gas sector, they come under, you know, attempted attacks on a daily basis. And when I say attempted attacks, it could just be probing. It could just be, you know, looking around for vulnerabilities. But the key issue here is that many of these attacks, most of these attacks are not successful, but it only takes one. And obviously, this attack is extremely major in that it has disrupted one of the main suppliers of oil and gas to the East Coast. And, you know, we're looking at potential shortages, looking at potential gas prices, you know, fluctuating. And it really underlines how just one attack can kind of, you know, throw into chaos the day-to-day operations in our 21st century world. And, you know, this is not by far from being the first successful attack on a critical infrastructure group. I mean, we saw just earlier this year, there was a very worrying, it was a successful breach, but not successful poisoning of the water supply in a town in Florida. And we've seen, you know, hackers really, scale up these attacks during the pandemic as well, as they're going after these vulnerable systems such as hospitals and schools. So it's a very worrying trend, but this attack in particular has had such a widespread impact that, it's very worrying for officials and experts alike.
This comes as President Biden has been advocating for a wide-ranging infrastructure spending proposal, and he says part of that is to harden the critical infrastructure. What does he want to do?
Well, his infrastructure proposal, it's a vast proposal that, you know, is meaning to, you know, scale up U.S. systems and their security. But, you know, one thing that I know that lawmakers on Capitol Hill have been really advocating for in recent weeks is increasing the focus in this package on infrastructure security, in particular cybersecurity. And I know lawmakers on both sides of the aisle, in a rare showing of bipartisanship these days, are really, you know, both coming together on, you know, trying to get these funds available for, you know, not only pipelines, but, you know, water infrastructure and the electric sector and any of these sectors that are key and critical to our day-to-day life. So I think, you know, while there is quite a bit of resistance on Capitol Hill from some portions to some parts of the infrastructure package, I think that President Biden will find a huge amount of bipartisan support, especially after this attack, for providing more resources and providing more funding to ensure these critical systems are secure.
We're talking with Maggie Miller with The Hill. You also found some members of Congress that made a comparison, the lack of preparedness in the U.S. to cyber attacks, to where the nation was before the 9/11 terrorist attacks in 2001. How scared are they?
Well, having covered cybersecurity for several years at this point, it has been interesting to see how lawmakers have really become, and I do mean on both sides of the aisle, more and more fixated on cyber threats and not just to critical infrastructure, but to, you know, all parts of our daily life. And, you know, I think that there's been a lot of comparisons to the findings of the 9/11 Commission in that, you know, they found after the attacks of September 11th that there were a lot of vulnerabilities that we had just not as a nation adequately addressed. And I think the quote that is often used for cybersecurity for many portions of national security concerns is that the lights are blinking red. And that phrase has been used by lawmakers on both sides of the aisle for several years at this point in terms of where we stand on cybersecurity as a nation. I mean, you only have to look at the SolarWinds attack earlier this year, which compromised 9 different federal agencies, or the recent breach of Microsoft's email application, which potentially compromised thousands of organizations. I mean, this is an escalating threat, and it's one that lawmakers are being forced to become interested in and address.
Maggie Miller with The Hill, staff writer, read her work at thehill.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down 34, S&P down 44, and NASDAQ down 350, 2.5%. Microsoft and Apple losing 2% each, Tesla dropping 6%. The Congressional Budget Office says the federal budget deficit in the first 7 months of the fiscal year is $1.9 trillion. That is larger than any full-year deficit, not including 2020, the height of the coronavirus pandemic. President Joe Biden today announcing new steps he says will help more Americans return to work, including the distribution of $350 billion from the $1.9 trillion COVID aid bill that was signed into law a couple months ago, the American Rescue Plan, that aid now going to state and local governments. President today also pushing back again against critics who say that expanded unemployment benefits encouraging Americans to not return to work. President says if there's a job offer, it must be taken.
We're going to make it clear that anyone collecting unemployment who is offered a suitable job must take the job or lose their unemployment benefits. There are a few COVID-19 related exceptions, so that people aren't forced to choose between their basic safety and a paycheck. But otherwise, that's the law. I know there's been a lot of discussion since Friday, since Friday's report, that people are being paid to stay home rather than go to work. Well, we don't see much evidence of that. That is a major factor. We don't see that. Look, it's easy to say the line has been, because of the generous unemployment benefits, that it's a major factor in labor shortages. Americans want to work. Americans want to work. As my dad used to say, a job's about a lot more than a paycheck. It's about your dignity, your place in the community, being able to look your kid in the eye and say everything's going to be okay. I think the people who claim Americans won't work, even if they find a good and fair opportunity, underestimate the American people. So we'll insist that the law is followed with respect to benefits, but we're not going to turn our backs on our fellow Americans.
President Joe Biden at the White House, referring to the jobs report for last month that was released on Friday, and the number of jobs created falling well below expectations. Today, the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell spoke about this on the Senate floor.
Now, I just spent the prior week talking with Kentuckians. I spoke with workers and employers at nearly every size of business from just about every kind of industry all across the spectrum. And from big national companies to local chambers of commerce to businesses like Manchester Tank and Campbellsville, we heard optimism, but also real concerns. Concerns about inflation and runaway costs. Concerned about backed up supply chains. And as Washington pays workers a bonus to stay unemployed, virtually everyone discussed very real concerns about their difficulties in finding workers who are willing to come back and fill these open positions. Almost every employer I spoke with specifically mentioned the extra generous jobless benefits as a key force holding back our recovery. Now, I've heard some Democrats say that whatever incentives Washington creates, the responsibility really falls on workers. But my friends on the other side can't use the American people to shield their own bad ideas from scrutiny. Policy matters. Incentives matter. It's May of 2021. Vaccines are available nationwide. There are millions of jobs open. Help wanted signs from coast to coast. We should not still be taxing the Americans who are working to fund continued extra benefits for those staying home. It's not March of 2020 anymore. It is May of 2021. Kentuckians and all Americans need our Democratic friends to govern accordingly.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. He'll be meeting on Wednesday with President Biden along with the other House and Senate Republican and Democratic leadership, discussing, among other things, infrastructure spending. The president has requested $4.1 trillion over two different bills. The senator from Kentucky, Mitch McConnell, says much of what the president wants is not traditional infrastructure. And Senator McConnell saying in a interview this weekend that a package of up to $800 billion might be acceptable to his party. By the way, that's $200 billion more than the last offer that Senator McConnell talked about. We spoke about all this with Eric Wasson, congressional reporter with Bloomberg News.
You know, that's the headline meeting of the week, this big four meeting, the first time that President Biden's met with the top four leaders in Congress. Pelosi, the House Speaker, and Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, will be there as well. There's also a follow-on meeting on Thursday with Shelley Moore Capito, Roger Wicker, and other key Republican players on infrastructure. So combined, they really are a real turning point. You know, Democrats are saying they're going to give bipartisanship a chance. They really have to do that because their members like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema really want to see a bipartisan infrastructure deal. So this is the chance for them to try to come together, especially on the issue of pay-fors, how to pay for an infrastructure bill. I'm thinking it could be be anywhere between the Republican offer of $600 billion to up to $1 trillion, or perhaps a little bit more, how to pay for it, come together on a deal, and we could see that come together at the end of the month when committees mark up. If things fall apart, however, we could quickly see Democrats turn to this budget reconciliation process that they used for the COVID-19 rescue package, the $1.9 trillion bill, in which they need all 50 Democrats and independents to vote together to ram something through. But they really can't try that process until they at least try to do a bipartisan deal, and this is the week where that could come together.
And so if that were to come together, would Republicans agree to spend more, and would Democrats agree to spend less?
Well, that's certainly one of the big questions. I think what they were trying to do, and I talked to Shelley Moore Capito in the halls of Congress before the latest Senate recess, was try to find out what are the needs. Let's find some data. Let's look at what are the exact needs and add them up. That's a way, you know, to get away from this, like, you know, dollar versus dollar type of debate and ground it in fact. And that's what staffers were working on. So if they can come together on real data as to what the roads, bridges, airports, you know, broadband internet needs are, perhaps they can find some common ground. But the stickier one will be how to pay for it. The Biden administration has talked about raising the corporate tax rate from 21% to 28%. You know, on the other families plan, talking about, you know, raising taxes on those making more than $400,000 per year. Those are polling pretty popularly. And so the White House is confident, you know, that there's a real chance that they could just do that and maintain political popularity. However, Republicans are rejecting that. They say do not reopen their signature Trump tax cuts from 2017, where those rates were lowered. And they're suggesting user fees. Interestingly, even a gas tax increase or a vehicle's mile traveled, which would be able to target electric vehicles that don't use gas, in addition to perhaps rolling back some of the spending. You know, I talked to Deb Fisher of Nebraska, a moderate, who said, you know, look, there's too much money going to state and local governments in the last package. Let's claw some of that back. So that's their proposals. It might be hard to find common ground on that, however.
As you know, the other headline, and this is from inside the Washington Times, as the House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy yesterday officially saying, yes, he is endorsing Elise Stefanik from upstate New York to replace Liz Cheney as the number three in the House leadership, chair of the House Republican Conference. That, by the way, taking place the same day that Leader McCarthy will be at the White House meeting with President Biden. The news yesterday from Fox News' Sunday Morning Futures with Maria Bartiromo on Fox News Business. Here's Leader McCarthy.
Now, any member can take whatever position they believe in. That's what the voters vote on the individuals, and they make that decision. What we're talking about is a position in leadership. We are in one of our biggest battles ever for this nation and the direction whether this next century will be ours. As conference chair, you have one of the most critical jobs of the messenger of going forward. Are we talking about what the Democrats are doing on the border? Are we talking about all the missed jobs report that we just had? Are we building an economy? Are we watching Joe Biden create inflation that we've never seen before, a takeover of government? The rising of taxes, the damage of what will be done that we cannot come back for. That's why we need a conference that's united. That's why we need a conference chair that is delivering that message day in and day out and uniting the nation to make sure that we are on the right footing going forward.
Do you support Elise Stefanik for that job?
Yes, I do.
That with Maria Bartiromo. So, Eric Watson, if you were in the room Wednesday, what would you be looking for?
Well, you know, I'm very interested in how this battle within the Republican Party affects these bigger Biden plans. You know, for us at Bloomberg, we're looking at the wider economy as well as the equities markets, and that $4 trillion package is a main focus for us. So when you look at the words that McCarthy was using in this program, he's really talking about the Democrats being destructive. He's using a lot of very strong rhetoric, and I think that makes deal-making more difficult. And my analysis is that these divisions within the Republican Party sort of serve to promote the idea of resisting Biden. Like, look at what happened when Mitch McConnell last week in Kentucky was asked about his own past comments about President Trump. He said he's 100% focused on stopping the administration. Now, that differs from rhetoric he's said in the past, and later he walked it back, saying he wants to do some deals with Biden if he becomes a moderate. So, you know, we're really seeing this idea that the Republican Party needs to unite to do that. They might need a common enemy of Biden. And that makes the kind of deal making that we see in more politically tranquil times, usually further away from an election, more difficult. So, you know, we're going to see, likely see Cheney ousted and replaced with Stefanik. Perhaps the waters calm down in the coming weeks. You know, there's not a huge deadline to get a deal, but we're very much looking to see how Republicans posture themselves toward the administration in the wake of all this turmoil within their own party.
Reporter Eric Wasson with Bloomberg. He covers Congress. Former President Trump putting out another statement Monday morning endorsing Congresswoman Elise Stefanik to take over for Liz Cheney as the third-ranking House Republican. Donald Trump writing, the House GOP has a massive opportunity to upgrade this week from warmonger Liz Cheney to gifted communicator Elise Stefanik. Congressman Adam Kinzinger is another of the 10 Republican House members who voted to impeach former President Trump in January, Liz Cheney also in that group. And he says it should be House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy, not Cheney, to be thrown out.
What I think has happened in the Republican Party is policy has been replaced by personal grievance and by culture war. And culture war is really motivating, right? When you get angry about the wokeism, you get angry about cancel culture, you get angry about, you know, what they're teaching in schools and all this kind of stuff, it really can overtake you that all you want to do is just destroy the other side of the aisle. And that's what the problem is leaders for the last 10 years have learned that fear and conspiracy drives profits and it drives votes. Fear is the most compelling human emotion. And so if you stand up and you make people fear, if you say that Nancy Pelosi is going to destroy this country or the left is going to, you know, destroy your children, or this happens even on the left about the right, it is a very compelling emotion. The problem is it destroys democracies. And I think that's what we saw on January 6th. So I'm a pilot, you know, a stall is what happens when you run out of flying airspeed and you fall out of the sky. But on every aircraft, just before you stall, it buffets. It's like a natural airframe shake to let you know, unintentionally, frankly, that you're about to fall out of the sky. And that's what January 6th was. It was a buffet. And I was very disappointed when my party's leaders, Kevin McCarthy and Steve Scalise in particular, decided that winning the next election and winning the majority was more important than a clear-eyed recognition of what happened on January 6th. What happened on January 6th was that a lie led to violence. You know, look, if you look at the people that attacked the Capitol, if you truly believe that the election was stolen, so just for a moment, suspend everything you believe and just think, okay, I truly believe the election was stolen. And you believe that it is Satanist pedophiles that run the government, which is what QAnon says. January 6th is not that crazy then, being as how that's what you really believe. And we've had leaders in our party, Donald Trump, members of Congress that have convinced their base, because it's more easier to do that than to tell them the truth, which is that 74 million people were not disenfranchised. They were outnumbered. It's easier to placate them. And we have convinced many, many Americans wrongfully. We've abused them and convinced them the election was stolen. So January 6th shouldn't be a surprise.
Congressman Adam Kinzinger at the National Press Club today. He also said that he warned leader Kevin McCarthy on a conference call with Republican House members just days before the attack on the Capitol January 6th that false claims about voter fraud would lead to violence, but that, quote, Kevin dismissively responded with, okay, Adam, operator, next question, and we got violence. Kevin McCarthy putting out a statement today officially scheduling that vote for Wednesday on ousting Liz Cheney. More on the investigation into the attack on the Capitol. House Administration Committee is hearing from the U.S. Capitol Police Inspector General. That when Washington Today continues in a minute. And welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. Wall Street Journal has an article. Pentagon officials considering pulling the plug on the Star-Crossed Jedi cloud computing project, which has been mired in litigation from Amazon and faces continuing criticism from lawmakers. The Joint Enterprise Defense Infrastructure contract was awarded to Microsoft in 2019 over Amazon, which has contested the award in court ever since. That contract worth $10 billion. California Governor Gavin Newsom, who last year projected a budget deficit in his state of up to $54 billion because of the coronavirus pandemic lockdowns, that would be a quarter of a state budget. Today, he says, they have more than a $75 billion surplus. And the U.S. Health and Human Services Department says it will protect against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity in healthcare. That reverses a policy from President Trump. House Administration Committee held another hearing today on the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, focusing on Capitol Police and their threat assessment and counter-surveillance before and during the attack, testifying the Capitol Police Inspector General Michael Bolton. Here's some of the questioning from Republican Congressman Rodney Davis.
Mr. Bolton, again, I want to turn to the Capitol Police's threat assessment and intelligence gathering analysis capabilities. Prior to January 6th, were you aware of the Capitol Police's deficiencies in counter-surveillance and threat assessment operations?
In regards to the threat assessment section, we did, and we had issued a report earlier recommending that they increase their amount of analysts and bringing some of their policy and procedures up to date. We had not looked at counter-surveillance since that was not a standalone entity that would not have fallen or come under our radar.
Okay. Can you speak to the department's current intelligence gathering and analysis capabilities? Are those executed at a sufficient level that you would have recommended in your previous reports yet?
When we conducted our previous report, they, as I stated, their caseload was very high, but since that report, their caseload has basically exploded to even larger numbers. So again, we're recommending that they increase their level of analysts and agents to work those cases because of the number of threat cases that have been generated on additional resources. Now, we also made a recommendation to utilize the FBI's behavioral analyst unit more frequently than what they did when we spoke to them. They indicated that they could take on much more cases than what we were previously providing them.
Great. Thank you for your responses there, Mr. Bolton. 10 years ago in Tucson, our former colleague Gabby Giffords and 18 others were shot by a gunman at an official event. Tragically, Representative Giffords was severely wounded, and 6 people were killed. Since then, there's been an exponential increase in the number of threats made against members of Congress. However, there has been no corresponding increase in the number of arrests or indictments. Can you explain why? Is this a resources issue for the department?
It may not be so much a resource issue for the department. It may be more of a resource issue for Department of Justice. Now, we haven't looked at the reasonings for the declination rate or the reasons for why the U.S. attorneys aren't taking the cases. So we haven't done any work in that field, so I wouldn't be able to give you a definitive answer. But there could be many factors as to why those cases, the subsequent rise in the threat cases isn't coinciding with the conviction rate.
U.S. Capitol Police Inspector General Michael Bolton with Congressman Rodney Davis, ranking Republican on the House Administration Committee. A Democratic member of the committee, Jamie Raskin, also asking about the role of analysts at the Capitol Police.
Mr. Bolton, there's a 30-to-1 officer to analyst ratio within the threat assessment section, and that's actually not just a ratio. Those are the actual numbers, if I'm reading it correctly, 30 officers to one analyst. How does that ratio compare to other federal law enforcement agencies? Do we need more analysts? And tell us why the work of analysts is important.
Thank you, sir. It's not even close to your other federal agencies, the 30-to-1 ratio. What our experience, not only mine with the Secret Service, but also a counterpart with the FBI, generally it's like either 5-to-2, 5-to-1 ratio is more the optimum. The analyst can take a lot of the burden off of your investigator, agents, officers, in conducting a lot of the checks, background checks, and doing a lot of the legwork initially to form up a package to provide to the special agents to review and to continue on whether or not they need additional steps. So they can carry a lot of the burden initially and get a lot of the work quicker done within hours as opposed to days. So those analysts are very important, as long as they're well-trained with the knowledge and the ability and have the skills, they can take a lot of that burden and they can turn these cases over quicker and more efficiently and making sure we don't miss any steps or we don't miss any particular information that's very important.
Your report says that the intelligence operations section, which is responsible for counter-surveillance, had only 13 officers deployed on January 6th to provide actual time intelligence to the department. Does the department have more than 13 counter-surveillance officers, or is that it? And if there were more, why weren't they deployed on the 6th? How many are there?
I believe that number is correct, sir. The problem we saw with counter-surveillance is it's not a standalone entity. So when we had the pipe bombs, three of the teams went to those pipe bombs, and because they're doing double duty, they started conducting an investigation that left one team to cover the Capitol complex. So in other words, if those pipe bombs were intended to be a diversion, plainly speaking, it worked. Yes, sir.
So how many officers were diverted to the pipe bombs at the DNC and the RNC?
Six. It would have been six. So it'd be three teams. The teams usually run with two.
So there were only seven officers left for the rest of the siege of the Capitol, basically.
Oh, two. So there were four teams initially. So it would have been just two there, and the other six, so eight would have been total.
U.S. Capitol Police Inspector General Michael Bolton with Congressman Jamie Raskin. The latest in a series of hearings by the House Administration Committee on the attack on the Capitol January 6th. You can find the full video at cspan.org. On Wednesday, the witnesses before this committee on this issue will be former Acting Defense Secretary Christopher Miller, former Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen, and Washington, D.C. Police Chief Robert Conte. No doubt they're going to be asked about the Defense Department waiting several hours before okaying the National Guard troops to be sent to the Capitol that day, despite pleas from the Capitol Police. In Jerusalem, hundreds injured as Israeli police fired tear gas, stun grenades, and rubber bullets. Palestinians throwing rocks. This near the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the Old City, known to Jews as the Temple Mount and to Muslims as the Noble Sanctuary. This comes during Israel's Jerusalem Day celebrations. Israeli nationalists parading through the city to assert their claim on the disputed area. And now Hamas militants in the Gaza Strip firing rockets towards Jerusalem, setting off air raid sirens throughout the city, and then Israel firing rockets back to Gaza, killing nine people, including three Hamas operatives, according to the Israeli military. Gaza's Ministry of Health saying three children also killed. In Washington, at the State Department, Associated Press reporter Matt Lee questioning State Department spokesman Ned Price.
When you talk about supporting Israel's right to defend itself, that includes, I'm assuming, but correct me if I'm wrong, that includes their retaliatory strikes against Hamas targets in Gaza, right?
We're speaking of the principle of self-defense.
I'm asking if you think that the principle of self-defense applies to the retaliatory, the airstrikes that they're conducting in response.
Matt, this is a very fluid situation. I would hesitate to comment on operations beyond, you know, the rocket fire that is clearly targeting innocent civilians in Israel. So I would hesitate to speak to specific operations that have just occurred, but the broader principle of self-defense is something we stand by on behalf of Israel and every other country.
Yeah, but do you think that an Israeli military response to the rockets coming in, a military response to the rockets coming in is covered by this broader rubric of self-defense, right?
Self-defense often does authorize the use of force.
This, there's an attempt, or was an attempt earlier, and maybe I've missed something since we've been in here, but at the UN Security Council for there to be a presidential statement about the situation, and it looks like you guys were holding it up. Can you explain what the... what the issue is?
Well, as you know, Matt, as we've commented on in different contexts, we don't discuss our actions during private consultations. What I will say, however, is that we want to see whatever comes out of the UN Security Council. We want to see to it that those products, be they statements or anything else, don't escalate tensions. That's our overriding priority.
State Department spokesman Ned Price. And with more, we're joined on the phone by Washington Post foreign affairs columnist Ishan Tharoor. Thanks so much for being with us. What do you make of what's been happening so far and whether this has the potential to escalate even further?
Well, it's certainly a fast-moving situation. What we're seeing right now, of course, is not exactly a reaction to events just today. It takes place in a series of clashes. It takes place in the aftermath of a series of clashes over the past few weeks in Jerusalem, where we've seen essentially what are Israeli extremists or provocateurs march through areas of the city where Arabs live, chanting death to Arabs. We've seen Israeli authorities fast-track or attempt to push forward the evictions of Palestinians in a particular neighborhood claimed by Israeli settlers. And so it takes place in this incredibly complicated scenario where, on one hand, what we're seeing are Palestinian militant groups in Gaza taking provocative action and firing rockets into Israel relatively indiscriminately. And then, of course, the Israeli retaliation proves even bloodier and provokes further Palestinian violence potentially. But at the same time, it's taking place in a context where Palestinians and elsewhere in Jerusalem and the West Bank are really mobilizing around a sense of profound dispossession, a sense of erasure, not just legally as Israelis push forward evictions of Palestinians from their homes, but also in terms of the broader conversation around the conflict. And it has a real potential right now for further escalation and violence.
There are reports that Israeli officials are asking the Biden administration not to get involved. Why might they do that, and what would the White House reaction likely be?
Well, the White House is walking a pretty tricky line. Of course, the Biden administration is not as close to the Israeli government of Prime Minister Netanyahu, Benjamin Netanyahu, as its predecessor, the Trump administration, which really pursued an agenda that was that amounted to a full embrace of Netanyahu's agenda. But at the same time, the Biden administration has indicated that first and foremost, it defends Israel's right for self-defense. It has issued only somewhat lukewarm condemnation of the moves we've seen that have led to some of the provocations in Jerusalem. And it doesn't seem that the Biden administration is particularly interested in really embroiling itself that much further into this conflict. It has a lot on its plate already. It's, as it is, trying to pivot American foreign policy away from the Middle East. And it doesn't really want to have to roll up its sleeves and dig in for a confrontation with the Israeli government, even though what we're seeing right now is at least among some corners of the American left, including a number of American of Democratic lawmakers in Congress, there is a growing criticism of the Israeli government, which is a right-wing government that's only getting more and more emboldened and further and drifting further to the right, a government that essentially no longer endorses the American policy of a two-state solution. And there's a sense that a real reckoning and recalibration needs to take place in Washington around the Israeli-Palestinian issue.
And this is all coming as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is trying to form a new government. How might that play out?
Yeah, this is part of the complexity of the moment. Netanyahu has always billed himself as the man who can defend Israel best. And he just was unable in the last week to form a government. So now the mandate to do so has been passed on to one of his rivals. We'll see what emerges. Israel has been locked in this 2-year cycle of its political parties being unable to form a stable ruling coalition. And so we've seen this cycle play out now over quite some time. At the same time, it's not just Netanyahu who is battling for political legitimacy. It's the leadership camps among the Palestinians as well. And you have in the West Bank, you have long-ruling Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, who recently canceled elections because and then, you have Hamas in Gaza. Neither of these political figures and groups or figures are popular among Palestinians. And so part of the violence is taking place in a context where the leadership, whether it's among the Israelis or the Palestinians, are for themselves battling for legitimacy. And on the Palestinian side, you have a huge body of youth, of activists who are really frustrated with the status quo. And that's not just down to the Israelis, but also to their own political leaders.
Ishan Tharoor is a Washington Post foreign affairs columnist. Read his work at WashingtonPost.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pierre S. Pete DuPont IV, former Delaware governor and congressman, ran for the Republican presidential nomination in 1988, has died. He died on Saturday. He was 86 years old. He was a fiscal conservative, supporter of a strong national defense. During his presidential campaign announcement in the fall of 1986, one of the first to announce that in that cycle, he spoke of his family who came to America and founded the DuPont Company. This from the C-SPAN Video Library.
187 years ago, a man named Pierre Samuel DuPont and his two sons left France to find an opportunity in a freer world. They and their descendants enjoyed that freedom and prospered with it. Today, one of those descendants has been given another extraordinary opportunity. He has been allowed the privilege of dreaming to lead the nation his ancestors risked everything to join. I'm sure that old Pierre is smiling as he looks down from the heavens today to hear his namesake say, "I am a candidate for president of the United States of America."
Pete DuPont in Wilmington, Delaware, 1986, announcing. He passed away over the weekend. Current U.S. Senator from Delaware Tom Carper, a Democrat, calls him one of the most important mentors that he's had. And current Delaware Governor John Carney, another Democrat, describes him as a real leader. And before we go on Washington Today, this from the Food and Drug Administration. It has approved Pfizer and BioNTech's request to allow their COVID-19 vaccine to be given to kids age 12 to 15 on an emergency use basis. That will allow states to get middle school and some high school students vaccinated before the fall term begins. Thanks for being with us on Washington Today. It's available as a podcast. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcast and download the free C-SPAN Radio app. Hope you have a good evening.